Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Radio Royalties, Little Peep and Apple. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
It's been a couple of weeks again since the last episode of Setlist, so we've picked a few of the big music industry stories from while we've been off. And during that time, we announced quite a few CMU-related things, so we should probably give those a quick mention.
We announced the themes for the 2020 edition of the Great Escape Conference. We are returning.
Once again.
Now, is that we Great Escape or we CMU? I could be wearing multiple hats there. Not that I am the Great Escape.
No.
But both are returning. That's the good news. The Great Escape is returning for its 15th year.
Mm-hmm.
It's year number 15.
It didn't seem that long since it was the 10th.
Well, it's 5 years, clearly.
Well, yeah.
Do the math.
It doesn't seem like that long, though.
Which means it's CMU's 10th year curating the key strands of the conference side of the Great Escape. And so once again, we will be presenting 3 full-day conferences on the Wednesday, Thursday, Friday of Great Escape week. And so what we have announced so far is the topics of our conferences, because of course we pick our 3 topics and then we do a full day on each of them.
Yeah.
And so that is what we have already announced. So I'll quickly run through them.
Go on then.
I will.
Go on.
I'm gonna.
Do it.
On the Wednesday,
mm-hmm.
the 13th of May, 2020,
yep.
We'll be doing our music education conference again. Now that's not a surprise.
No.
Because the first day is now always our focus on music careers and music education. So it's the 3rd year in a row that we've had our music education focus. But through all of that work that we've been doing on music education, which we now put under the banner Pathways into Music, and we are basically putting together a book all about music careers, music education, and the role that educators and mentors and peers and ultimately the industry have in supporting new talent. So the Pathways into Music book, we are going to be publishing chapter by chapter over the next few months, and then it will all come together at the Great Escape.
Be like they did in Victorian times.
Sherlock Holmes. Yes.
So you're saying education should go back to the Victorian times?
Almost certainly the opposite of that. But we may be delivering our message in that style. So a bit like last year.
You and Charles Dickens, you're basically the same person.
The second day of The Great Escape last year was kind of like the conference version of the Dissecting the Digital Dollar book. That's what we did last year. And so then the first day of The Great Escape 2020 will be the conference version of this Pathways into Music book.
Mm.
So that's the Wednesday. And then on the Thursday, we're going to put the focus on music media, which we did a few years ago.
Yeah.
Not that long since we last had our music media conference. That day was basically a full day looking at, well, the premise last time was, if you think the music industry's fucked, come and look at the music media. That was basically the theme of the whole day. Quite a negative day, really.
Yeah.
But, well, lots of positive panelists, but I still claim that most of them were in denial. So from my perspective, it was a negative day. They were great panelists, I take that back. But
no, you've said it now, it's too late.
This one is going to be more positive.
Yeah.
Not because the music media is no longer fucked,
yep.
But because we are expanding the definition of media.
Okay.
So we will be looking at the music press, we will be looking at music radio, but we'll also be looking at, for example, how people are using Twitch and Fortnite and gaming platforms to reach audiences. We'll be looking at podcasts.
Yeah.
And the rise of podcasts. And the music podcasts, and then the people who are dabbling with platforms. I mean, obviously, Mixcloud has long been the leader in this, but there are other people trying to make it easier for people to do music podcasts without immediately running into all sorts of licensing nightmares. We're going to be looking at how certain artists have been doing what, in essence, are sync deals with TV programs, for example, but they're more than a sync deal. So maybe the artist ends up in the program, or there's some spin-off or whatever. And all of those sorts of things. So what is music media in 2020 and how do artists connect with it? That will be the second day, Thursday, the 14th of May,
mm-hmm.
2020.
Yep.
And then on the Friday, we'll be looking at global music markets. So you know how a few years ago we went super focused and we did a whole day on China.
Yeah, I remember.
This time we're doing the opposite of that. And we're doing the entire world.
Okay.
The entire world in one day. So what that means is we'll basically, as you go through the day, we'll break the world down into its usual regions and we'll look at the key trends in streaming, touring, social, etc. in each of those regions. So, you know, Europe, Asia Pacific, North America, Latin America, Africa, etc., etc. And then in amongst all of that, we will then put the spotlight on a bunch of rapidly expanding markets. So we will have a little bit more on China. We'll check in on what's happened on China in the last 2 to 3 years, because a lot's happened since we put our spotlight on China. But we'll also be looking at places like India, Nigeria, which is kind of becoming the hub for sub-Saharan Africa when it comes to exciting things happening in the digital music space. And we'll put the focus on South Korea because I know you're a big K-pop fan. So it means you'll be able to come and learn more about K-pop. Because as well as announcing our themes for 2020, we also announced that South Korea is our lead country partner in 2020. So Great Escape always has a spotlight country. So 2020, it will be South Korea. So there'll be lots of bands coming over from South Korea on the festival side. But we will also put a spotlight on what is happening in that market. Rapidly expanding market as part of our global music markets.
Yes.
Yes. Conference on the Friday. So you can get tickets for this already if you go to the Great Escape website. Delegate Pass will get you into all of that. Or if you're...
No, I'll probably just blag him for free.
I won't let you.
Oh, you're not talking to me.
I won't let you. Oh. I will tell the press team, don't want that chancer Andy Malt blagging his way in, pretending to be a journalist. That's what I will say to the press team. So buy yourself a Delegate Pass. Or if you're just interested in the music education stuff, and the pathways into music work, then there is a standalone ticket you can get just for day one, the Wednesday of the Great Escape, also available from the Great Escape website.
Yeah, but we're not here to discuss that.
We also announced one other thing.
Oh, what?
Basically, it was the AGM of AIM, the Association of Independent Music, earlier this month. And at that, it was confirmed that the report that we've been working on with AIM for a while, looking at the evolution of the music distribution sector, called Distribution Revolution, and we're launching it in November, so that was confirmed. And if you're an AIM member, there is a workshop and a launch event that you can book tickets for, and then the report will be available to everybody. So basically looking at how the role of the music distributor has changed, the services that distributors now offer. What is the difference between a music distributor that offers all the services of a label and a label? So that's one of the things that is discussed in that report, which will be coming out next month.
Well, how exciting. And yet another thing that we're not going to discuss at all this week. We won't say anything about it. Yes, we're actually this week, we're going to discuss late rapper Lil Peep's mother suing his former management team and Apple possibly launching bundles of TV and music, and why the label's possibly not so happy about that. But first, to mark the one-year anniversary of America's Music Modernization Act being signed into law earlier this month, the boss of the US Collecting Society Sound Exchange and rapper Common had a good old moan.
They did.
They teamed up to pen together for some reason. Still not sure why.
It didn't really explain. I mean, I'm sure that the boss of Sound Exchange and Common chat about these things all the time.
I'm not sure Common's more of a draw than Michael Hupp, but why not just credit it to Common and just pretend he wrote it?
I mean, because I think it was very clearly written by the boss of a collecting society. I think that's probably why they had to have the co-credit.
Anyway, they teamed up to write an op-ed piece for Variety magazine arguing that copyright music laws in the country are actually yet to be modernised, not because the Music Modernisation Act hasn't really done anything yet, but because the big AM/FM radio get-out remains. What's that, Chris?
Well, the Music Modernization Act was that big piece of legislation that went through US Congress. Well, it was signed into law a year ago, as we've already said.
Yes.
Actually, I was checking a report on it being signed into law. I'd forgotten this. The headline was something like, Donald Trump signs MMA into law, Kanye West waffles a lot.
Yes. That was the thing where Kanye sort of gatecrashed.
He did. Well, people thought that he was coming because they had various mainly old white musicians in the room while Donald Trump was signing it into law. People heard Kanye was coming to the White House, so they assumed he was coming to be part of that. But then it turned out he was just having lunch with Donald Trump later in the day, and he wasn't there for the signing of the MMA. And then he subsequently gave an interview and talked a load of nonsense, as only Kanye can.
Yes.
But yes, it is a year since the MMA became law, and it was passed by Congress shortly before that. And it was a major, sometimes said once in a lifetime, but clearly not, a major overhaul of music copyright law in the US. And actually, the MMA began its life as several separate pieces of legislation that got merged together. And if you, and I'm sure most people did, saw my session... At MeDem 2018.
That wasn't where I thought it was going. Yep.
Which I think is on YouTube, so you've got no excuse for not seeing it, which was all about the Music Modernization Act. And I kicked it off by talking about all the ways in which American copyright law is a bit weird. So I had my top five American copyright law quirks, and I talked through all the ways in which American copyright law from a European perspective is just a bit odd. And the Music Modernization Act set out to address a bunch of those issues. So, for example, the mess around the way that mechanical royalties are paid and mechanical rights are licensed on the song side of the business, which led to all of those multi-billion dollar lawsuits involving Spotify, etc. The MMA seeks to sort all of that out by amending the compulsory license that covers mechanical rights in the US, and finally setting up a mechanical rights collecting society in America, which the publishing sector there forgot to set up. So that was one of the quirks, the fact that mechanical rights were a mess in America, and the MMA, in theory, is going to sort that out. Then there was the whole 1972 nonsense.
Yep.
The fact that if you had released a record before 1972, chances were that things like Pandora and Sirius weren't paying you any royalties due to a technicality. So that technicality was removed. It solved that. Then there was things about the way that the rate courts, the special courts that oversee the licenses issued by the songwriting collecting societies, BMI and ASCAP, it was felt that the criteria that those courts used were out of date and they were wrong. It was one of the weird things about American copyright law. The MMA solved that. So the Music Monetization Act was set up to overhaul all these different areas of American copyright law, but...
Well, it sounds like it sorted everything out, though, but...
But...
What?
Mike and his mate Common are correct in saying that my number one copyright quirk, my Medium thing last year, was the fact that AM and FM radio stations, so not online radio, but AM and FM radio stations in the US... are not obliged to get themselves a license from the record industry, which means they don't have to pay any royalties to any labels or artists for any of the recordings they play. And that is very unusual.
It is.
In most other countries, like this one, when a radio station plays some music, they have to have two licenses and pay two sets of royalties. So they need one license covering the song, and they have to pay royalties through to the publishers and the songwriters, but they need a separate license covering the recordings, and that then would then be shared out between the artists and the labels. But American copyright law treats sound recordings and songs a little bit differently. And if you look at the American Copyright Act, when it talks about song copyrights, and when it talks about what I call the controls that come with the copyright, it looks very much like it does over here. But when you look at the sound recording copyright in the American Copyright Act, what you will notice is that when it comes to the list of controls that come with the copyright, there is one missing. And that's what we would colloquially over here refer to as the performing rights, or sometimes they're called the neighbouring rights. And for sound recordings in America, those don't exist. There is a digital performance right, which was added in the 1990s, which is why online radio stations do have to pay royalties. But there isn't what we would call a general performing right that would apply to AM and FM radio stations. And it's been like that forever. So sound recordings were added to federal copyright law in the early 1970s. Hence that 1972 thing that I talked about earlier. And as it's been explained to me by people who know, when the record industry went to Congress in the very early 1970s and said we want sound recordings added to federal US-wide copyright law, because prior to that, sound recordings hadn't been part of the US-wide copyright system. You had been able to protect sound recordings on a state-by-state level, but the way it worked varied from state to state. So the record industry went to Congress and said we want sound recordings inserted into US-wide federal law. And when they were doing that, the radio industry basically said to the record industry, well, hang on a second, if you're going to formalise recording rights and you're going to get them properly written into law, if that means that we're going to have to start paying you royalties, then we're going to block this. We'll lobby against this. We'll stop you from getting a federal sound recording copyright. So in essence, the record industry came up with a deal with the radio industry, which was to say, well, what if, unlike everywhere else in the world, well, that's not true. There are some other countries where there isn't a performing right for recordings. But unlike most of the other big markets in the world, we won't put a performing right in for recordings. We'll exclude that. So we'll have our copyright, the reproduction bit, which is what, at that point, the record industry was really interested in, because obviously they were selling records. So we'll have that bit, but we'll exclude the performing right. And the radio industry were like, oh, that's fine. If you're not going to make us pay you royalties, then we won't object to what you're trying to do, getting recordings added to federal copyright law. So that was a deal that was done. The record industry almost immediately regretted doing that deal. And pretty much ever since has been campaigning to try and get American copyright law brought in line, for example, with European copyright law, so that there is a performing right, neighbouring rights, inserted into sound recordings under the American system, which would mean that AM and FM radio stations would have to start paying royalties. And I think Frank Sinatra was the first artist to speak out on this. So that's how long ago it was that this campaign began. But in more recent years, there was a piece of legislation that's been in Washington in various different forms called the Fair Play, Fair Pay Act. And so that's been on the table in Washington for ages. But the radio industry in America remains a really powerful lobby, partly because talk radio is huge in America in a way that it isn't really over here. And talk radio in America is very political. So in some ways, the radio industry is powerful in Washington in the way that the tabloid newspapers are powerful in London, in Westminster. So the radio industry is a very powerful lobby and have done a very good job of ensuring that even though that legislation has been around in various forms for years now, and of course, as I've already said, there was other proposals before it, none of that has ever really progressed in any serious way towards actually becoming a proper reform of American copyright law.
But you said earlier that the Music Modernization Act was really an amalgamation of lots of bits of legislation relating to music copyright law lumped together and then got through as one thing. So why wasn't the Fair Play, Fair Pay Act part of that?
Well, had you watched that MeDem session from 2018 on YouTube, I asked that very question to the then boss of your favourite trade organisation.
Oh, no.
The RIAA. And I said, given that from the record industry side, I mean, on the publishing side, for songwriters, the mechanical rights nonsense, that was the biggest issue, followed by the rate courts. But on the recording side, okay, yes, the 1972 thing was a problem, but really, this is the big issue for the record industry. Why isn't it in there? And he said, quite sensibly, that they just had to be a bit pragmatic about this, and they realised that most of the other bits of legislation, there were some opponents in Washington to them, but that there was probably deals that could be done.
Mm.
And so they were quite confident that if they talked to the right people and did a couple of deals, they could try and get as much support and as little opposition for all of the other elements as possible, put them into one package, push them through as fast as you can through Senate and House of Representatives and get it into law. Whereas they recognised that the radio industry was going to put on a big fight for the Fair Play, Fair Pay Act, like they always had. And so the fear was, if we try to put radio royalties into this, it's going to kill it. And then that means we won't get the mechanical royalties thing fixed, and we won't get the rate court reforms, and we won't get the 1972 thing addressed. So, even though we don't really want to, just for practical reasons, we'll park the radio royalties, we'll get everything else through, and then we'll come back to the radio royalties, which is what is happening right now.
Yeah, so now with everything the MMA was supposed to put in place, kind of getting up and running, certainly towards sorting things out, hopefully, they're going to turn their focus back to the radio royalties issue.
Hence why Mike and Common got their pens out and penned a little piece for Variety in which they...
How do you think they did it? Like one word?
At
alternating
a time.
Words or alternating letters? They did like a game of consequences. Just see what happened.
Backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
I suspect someone in the PR department at Sound Exchange wrote it. and then Common sent in a photo. But, I mean, what do I know? I know nothing. But basically, this article, I guess, resets out the arguments, counters the predictable argument that's going to come back from the radio industry, and then had a bit of a rally call at the end, didn't it?
Yes. So they... together, probably harmonising.
In perfect unison.
Yeah, well, I mean, Common might have rapped it.
Yes, maybe he was freestyling on
maybe
top.
Michael Hupp can rap. Who knows? Maybe they both rapped. Maybe Michael Hupp's a better rapper than Common. We just don't know.
We don't know.
There's not a lot of rhymes in this article, though. So
no.
I'm going to guess they harmonised. They said, the biggest and most profitable music platform in America, FM radio, with 200 million plus listeners, and $17 billion in annual revenue, pays nothing to the people who record the music that is the lifeblood of their business. Never have. Not a penny.
They then said that when this issue has gone before lawmakers in Washington in recent years, which as we say, it has on many times, some people in Congress have said, well, can't you do a deal with the radio industry? And I suppose there is a little bit of precedent in that we did have a few deals. This is quite a long time ago now. In the early days of online radio, where some labels did some deals with some radio companies,
right.
Where they basically said, okay, under law, we have to pay you a statutory rate for online radio. We don't have to pay you anything for FM radio. So what if we do a bit of a deal and you agree to a lower rate on online radio, but we'll start paying you a rate on FM radio? And if I remember, I think Big Machine, then Taylor Swift's label, were one of the record companies that were looking into doing a deal like that with one of the radio firms. So it's not unprecedented that there hasn't been some deal-making going on behind the scenes, but basically what they were saying in this opinion piece was, in the past, Congress has said, can you not do a deal? But it's very hard to do a deal when the radio industry can just walk away from that deal and pay you nothing.
Yeah. If their starting point is, we have everything and we don't want to give you anything, and what are you going to do about it?
So Mike and Common were saying, enough talk of us doing some sort of backroom deal. We need American copyright law to be modernized so that it comes in line with copyright law in most of the rest of the world. And we have a proper performing right for sound recording copyright that would oblige AM/FM radio stations to come forward and get a license.
Yes. They said, we can right this wrong with the simple act of giving music creators a property right in their own work. No one can call our copyright laws modernised until FM radio is held to the same standard as the music services it competes with on the dashboard and in American homes, the ones who pay artists. This is the longest standing inequity in our copyright laws, and it's time to get real about solving it.
I mentioned that they also dealt with the classic comeback from the radio industry, and basically the radio industry has had the same comeback since pretty much 1972 on this.
It's a good one.
Which is airplay is promo. People hear your music, they discover your artists. You should be paying us. We're helping you reach an audience and sell your bloody records. So therefore, quid pro quo, we shouldn't owe you any money.
Yes, and back in the days where more people bought records, there was a bit of a stronger argument. Although now, as they noted in that quote I just read out, radio is competing with the streaming services for listeners. Radio did not compete with CDs for the listeners. Well, not so much anyway. But yeah, so they're saying now that the argument that it's free promo and it sells CDs doesn't stand up anymore.
Yeah, so even if that argument worked in the past, which I think the record industry would argue, it never really stood up. But even if it did, it doesn't work anymore. Also, I mean, there are quite a lot of like golden oldie radio stations. I mean, you might conceivably get away with that if you're just playing new music by new artists. But when you're playing 60s classics all day, I think your audience have already discovered those 60s classics and they're not rushing out to buy records because you're suddenly playing them.
In today's digital economy, they said, 75% of US recording revenue derives from streaming. The law, the marketplace, and simple morality demand that digital platforms must share some of that value with creators. Why should radio be any different? It is, after all, the music that draws their audience.
So that's them told.
Mm.
And then at the end, as I said, there was a rallying call basically saying the entire music community, which did come together, remember, 18 months ago for the Music Modernization Act,
yes,
need to rally again and have another push on this. There was a weird sentence at the end of the article.
Mm.
I don't know if this got edited somewhere along the line, because they're basically trying to say everyone needs to get involved in this. So that now is the time to take action. They said we must come together and call upon Congress to right these wrongs. Whether you're an artist,
yep,
get that, or a senator, well, that figures, because okay, they're the people who can change the law, or a construction worker, we all deserve to be paid properly. Now, I assume that's
Well, there was a construction worker in the Village People. Maybe that's what they mean.
I don't know if that's because earlier on they were talking about property rights.
Right.
And that's what they're thinking about. But, I mean, obviously, yes, there's an element of...
Or maybe they're saying construction workers are radio listeners and they should care about whether or not artists make money.
Well, if they were trying to say, well, we should all care about this, yeah, then you need a longer list.
It
don't
is
you?
A weirder way. It is a weird way of saying that.
It should be saying lorry drivers and hairdressers and
bank
lawyers
managers
and accountants and bank managers rather than just to have
school teachers,
artists, senators, and construction workers.
But people who make sandwiches.
Common has spoken. So builders. of America.
Just builders.
It's your responsibility.
Maybe they should threaten to build a wall around Congress.
They should march on Washington with their bricks and mortar,
yeah,
and demand a proper radio royalty, a proper performing right for the recording artists of America. So, yeah, that's back on the agenda. I mean, we kind of knew that, but it was in an op-ed in Variety. So these things only really matter when a rapper puts their name to an article they clearly didn't write in a trade publication.
I think he did write it. I think Michael Hupp had nothing to do with it.
He was just coming in the last minute looking for some
riding
glory.
Riding on the coattails.
So, interesting article. If you're very good, Andy will link to it from the podcast notes.
Yeah, probably will. Still to come, why the record labels are not necessarily happy with Apple's new plans for streaming bundles. But now one of the big interesting lawsuits that's been filed in the last few weeks. The mother of Little Peep has sued his former management team at First Access Entertainment, accusing them of negligence and other breaches of contract, which, the lawsuit alleges, contributed to the rapper's death in 2017 of an accidental drugs overdose. The management firm has insisted that the claims made in the legal filing are categorically untrue, adding that we look forward to the lawsuit's swift dismissal.
Yes, this is a very interesting bit of litigation that has been filed. Whether or not you think there is any substance to the case, you can have your own opinion on that. But certainly it's an interesting lawsuit and also plays into an interesting ongoing debate in the music industry. So obviously the rapper Lil Peep died in late 2017, really when his career was just starting to gain momentum.
Yeah.
He was an artist who originally found an audience on SoundCloud, then got signed up by the music industry and had been touring America and elsewhere. In the run-up to November 2017, he was only age 21 when he died, far, far too young. As you say, the coroner's report confirmed that it was an accidental drugs overdose. And it was interesting at the time, obviously very tragic at the time, but an extra layer of interest, I guess, because of the subject matter of quite a lot of his work that preceded that, which talked quite a bit about depression and drug use and so on and so forth.
Yes, although after his death, his brother said that actually the drug use side was something that he kind of exaggerated on stage and in his music and wasn't as serious as he made out. Although he did concede that his brother's drug use had grown as he'd become more involved with the music industry.
Which in essence brings us to this case. So yeah. This is a lawsuit filed by his mother. And in essence, it's accusing his management team, who were ultimately the London-based First Access Entertainment, but then there are various people named in the case, so his more hands-on manager, Bryant Ortega, and then also Belinda Mercer, who was on the tour management side and had been touring with the rapper earlier in the year. And they're all accused of negligence, and basically the gist of the case is that the culture on the tour, but also outside of the tour, was one where drugs were readily available, where drug use was condoned and in some cases encouraged. And in essence, what his mother is saying is that that was negligent on the part of the management team and the tour management team, given that they knew that he had issues with addiction to certain drugs, both illegal drugs, but also prescription medication, and that therefore they had a responsibility of trying to build an environment where drugs were not readily available, where the people around him were not consuming drugs, and where drugs were not so easily available. And the lawsuit goes into a lot of detail with a lot of very specific allegations. Now, it may well be, given that First Access have been quite resolute in disputing certainly the key arguments of this case, and they may as yet specifically dispute some of the events that are described. But basically, the lawsuit does tell the story of his rise up on SoundCloud, his going into business with the First Access team, and then the alleged environment on the tour and various incidents that happened along the way involving the supply of drugs and the use of drugs, and basically building up this picture of saying you created an environment where the outcome, the tragic outcome, was, well, I mean, the lawsuit goes as far as saying, in essence, it was an inevitable outcome of the environment that had been built.
Yeah, so in the lawsuit, it alleges that during that 2017 headline tour, the use of controlled substances and illegal drugs by Lil Peep, certain defendants and others involved in the tour, including the tour manager, was allowed, normalised and even encouraged and promoted by the defendants. The defendants viewed this type of dangerous behaviour as part of the scene on a tour like this one. More disturbingly, defendants knew that the continued use of dangerous drugs on this tour by many, including Lil Peep, allowed the defendants to maintain a certain degree of control over the tour and its artists. It says that on the final date of a tour earlier in the year, Lil Peep was barely able to communicate, let alone perform, due to his use of drugs. Despite his comatose-like state and the fact that he was in clear medical distress, the defendants nonetheless allowed him to go on stage to perform without any intervention, medical or otherwise. It also, as well as talking about his drug use on tour, there are allegations that his management team facilitated his access to drugs outside of touring as well, specifically citing text messages which allegedly show that the First Access boss Sarah Stennett and Ortega were arranged to provide Lil Peep with unprescribed Xanax pills.
Yeah, the lawsuit has these various text messages which alleges are arranging to deliver these unprescribed prescription drugs to him. I mean, the text messages in isolation are a little bit open to interpretation, but that is what they are alleging. And then they say that none of the management team were medical professionals or pharmacists. So they were not licensed to providing these drugs to Lil Peep. And so therefore, as far as the lawsuit is concerned, this is just adding to the argument as to why this management team were negligent. They later on talk about how at one point during the year, Little Peep had told his management team that actually the entire experience, the tour, was causing too much anxiety, and actually he wanted out of it all, and that they put pressure on him to carry on touring. So lots and lots of different allegations building in this lawsuit, ultimately seeking to hold First Access and the team and those individuals who are named very much in the lawsuit somehow liable for negligence for creating the environment that, as far as the lawsuit is concerned, ultimately contributed to his death.
Yeah, the key allegation in the lawsuit is that Lil Peep's death was a foreseeable consequence of the callous, unsafe environment on the tour bus and recklessness, carelessness, negligence, and intentional conduct of the defendants. It also quotes a tweet from Ortega, which he posted shortly after Lil Peep's death, in which he said, "I've been expecting this call for a year. Motherfuck."
So a lot of very bold allegations in this lawsuit leading up to the ultimate argument that there was negligence and that contributed to the rapper's death. First Access put out a very quick and quite detailed statement in response, which, as we've already said, are very dismissive of the lawsuit and are optimistic that the case will ultimately be dismissed without ever properly going to court. Meanwhile, they argued very forthrightly that any allegation that First Access or any of the people actually named in the lawsuit somehow actively contributed to the death of Little Peep were that those claims are categorically untrue. And later on, they deem those allegations offensive.
Yes, so the company said, "Little Peep's death from an accidental drug overdose was a terrible tragedy. However, the claim that First Access Entertainment, any of its employees, or anyone else under our auspices was somehow responsible for, complicit in, or contributed to his death is categorically untrue. In fact, we consistently encouraged Peep to stop abusing drugs and to distance himself from the negative influence of the drug users and enablers with whom he chose to associate. It is extremely disappointing that Peep's mother would file this meritless lawsuit, since she was well aware of the numerous efforts made by First Access and Ortega to steer her son away from his concerning life choices. Unfortunately, in spite of our best efforts, he was an adult who made his own decisions and opted to follow a different, more destructive path."
The statement ultimately concluded, "While First Access is deeply saddened by Little Peep's untimely death, we will not hesitate to defend ourselves against this groundless and offensive lawsuit. We look forward to its swift dismissal." So, as I say, a very interesting lawsuit following on from a very tragic moment in recent music history. I would expect, if the case proceeded and got to court, that First Access would actually take issue with many of the specific allegations in the litigation, as well as the sort of overriding claim. Although, there's also an interesting side debate, which is, even if First Access and the team didn't dispute some or all of the events described in the lawsuit, even if all of it did happen as the lawsuit describes, which obviously we don't know, but if it did, I would say even then, there is arguably a leap to be taken to prove in court that the events as described in the lawsuit constitute negligence in the legal sense of the word. Because obviously we can say somebody is negligent and that's a matter of opinion, but then there is the legal concept of negligence. And whether or not you could argue that there are legal liabilities here is an interesting point. And if the case was to proceed, obviously First Access hope that it won't, but if it was, there will be some very interesting legal debates to be had. But even beyond what happens to this lawsuit next, whether or not it gets to court, maybe it won't, probably it won't. But I suppose the other reason why this is interesting is it does play into a wider debate that's been going on, obviously, in recent years in the music industry about the industry's responsibility to the health and well-being of its artists. And of course, the debate in particular has been around mental health and also around addiction. And there's been a lot of talk about that. We've talked about it before on the podcast. And in the management community, particularly debate on what is the role of the manager. Because, of course, artists have multiple business partners, but the one business partner that has a connection with the artist 365 days a year is the manager. So the manager is the one business partner who sees everything. And so what are the responsibilities of the manager when it comes to the health and well-being of their artist? And even if we accept that the manager does have a responsibility for the health and well-being of the artist, which I think most people would, but then, is the manager either qualified or empowered to do anything about it?
Yes, because the artist is the manager's employer, not employee.
Which is,
so you can fire someone who, if they start saying stuff you don't like, which is often what happens.
And that was what was alluded to in First Access's statement, which is, as the manager, there is only so much you can do. And what do you do if you say to the artist, we don't think you should be doing this, we don't think you should be hanging out with these people, we don't think this should be happening? And the artist pushes back and says, I don't care what you think, this is what I want to do. Now, It may be that Little Peep's family might dispute the extent to which that advice was being given. But that is a challenge. You know, there is only so much a manager can do. Plus, of course, you know, managers, first and foremost, are there to be business minds. They're there to be entrepreneurial. They're there to do the deals. They're there to be the person who makes sure that all the different business partners are talking to each other and working together. Layering on top of that, being in essence the counsellor of the artist, is a big responsibility for managers to take on. And obviously that has been, certainly on this side of the Atlantic, a big conversation in recent years in the management community. The Music Managers Forum has done some work in this area and Help Musicians and an organisation called Music Support have done some work in this area of, if we are saying that managers have some responsibility for the health and well-being of their artists, particularly in the context of mental health and addiction, is, well, managers aren't really qualified to do that. So what support mechanisms are there? What are the danger signs they should be looking out for? And given that they aren't the qualified people to then step in, where can they go? Where is the help, whether it's in the industry or it's in the NHS or wherever, where is the support that they can go to so that they can then support their artist or at least advise their artist to take that support?
Yeah, so this is obviously an ongoing debate, and it'll be interesting to see if this lawsuit informs that debate, particularly in the US, where I think the debate is fairly well advanced over in the UK, where there's been quite a lot of work and research and various different studies and guides published on it. But I think there's less so in the US at this stage.
And of course, just because of the way healthcare is provided in the US, there is the added challenge there, at least here in the UK. I mean, sometimes it can be hard navigating the NHS and finding the right people within the NHS, but there is a free to access support mechanism out there if you just know the right people to target and the right questions to ask. Whereas obviously in the US, you immediately have the issues of, if we are going to bring in professional support for the artist, who's paying for that and how much will it cost, etc., etc. But yes, an interesting debate. Anyway, layering a bunch of legal arguments on top of that and actually thinking about the liabilities of the manager, even if, as First Access are basically saying, this case doesn't really have much substance, it is an interesting other angle to an ongoing conversation.
You mentioned there various organisations that support people with issues relating to mental health and addiction. I'll put links to all those in the show notes for this episode, including the MMF's guide for music managers on looking after the mental health of their artists and themselves. And finally, one of the most interesting bits of streaming gossip from the last few weeks. Apple is apparently in talks with the labels about bundling Apple Music in with its new TV service, Apple TV Plus. And that'll be great, and everyone will be happy.
Or maybe not.
Oh, right, okay.
Possibly not. Yeah, so Apple are going big into the online subscription domain. Obviously, Apple Music has been going for a few years now, but they announced earlier this year these new services, which are now slowly but surely going live. So they've got their gaming service. There's a news service as well, isn't there?
Oh, yeah.
And then the big one, I suppose, that everyone is most aware of is what is always billed as their Netflix competitor, is their move into video on demand and all of that with TV Plus. All of these services are busy going live in various countries around the world. And what the Financial Times was reporting on recently, this is why this was a talking point, is that behind the scenes, Apple, pretty obviously I would say, are thinking, okay, now we've taken all of these services to market in isolation, the obvious thing to do is to start bundling them.
Yeah.
So that we have a combined TV and gaming offer, which means that the people who are most interested in the gaming, maybe we can upsell them TV. The people who are most interested in the TV, maybe we can upsell them some gaming. Totally makes sense that that is what they would want to do. And that includes bundling TV Plus with music. And so what the Financial Times was saying in its report is that talks are now going on with the record companies about how that might be achieved. Because although the bundling of music streaming with other products isn't new, obviously the most common bundles to date have been the mobile bundles,
yeah,
where the music gets bundled in with a mobile subscription. But there have been other bundles too. I think at one point you could get Spotify with your Times newspaper,
yes,
subscription.
Yeah.
So there have been bundles before, but crucially, the way digital licensing works on the music side is when the record companies do their deals with companies like Apple, in essence, it's a separate deal for every manifestation of the product. So if you look at, say, Spotify in the UK, actually, as a label or a distributor or a publisher or a collecting society, you're doing a deal around the free version, a deal around the £10 a month version, a deal around the Vodafone bundle, a deal around the student discount, a deal around the family plan, and so on and so forth. So even though Apple Music has its deals in place, if they want to create a new product that bundles the music with something else, they'll have to go and get an extra bit added on to their deals. And so that's what's being talked about at the moment. And as you alluded to, although on one level, surely everybody's a winner by putting music with TV, because Apple have been busy trying to sell music as a standalone product. They've signed up whatever it is. It's over more than 50 million now, isn't it? 50 million paying subscribers. But maybe there are people out there who would never think to come online and subscribe to a paid-for streaming music service, but they're excited about Apple's competitor to Netflix. And if, when they go to sign up to Apple's competitor to Netflix, they're told, oh, well, what about this option that also gets a load of music? Maybe you can turn those people into music subscribers as well as video subscribers, and everybody's a winner, because we're now selling music subscriptions to people who would not normally go out of their way to buy such a thing. So there is a perfectly decent argument to the music industry. This is brilliant. We're going to help you sign up yet more people to paid-for streaming. Paid-for streaming is what is driving growth in the record industry. How could you possibly object? But as you alluded to, there is some pushback, we are told, from some people at some of the labels.
Of course there always is, isn't there?
Because there always is.
Well, I suppose, I mean, the most obvious comparison for this would be Amazon, which obviously bundles all sorts of stuff together in its Prime membership, which includes its video service and its music service. So that's already happening. That's already licensed. That exists. And why would Apple doing the same thing not be as attractive as that?
The concern from the music industry side, of course, is that, okay, let's say that Apple Music is $10 a month. The video service is launching at $5, £5 a month to undercut Netflix. So to buy
it also
both
has less content on it. I mean, I think it's
there will be less content on it initially, anyway.
Yes. So
that's £15 together. So clearly, for the bundled version to be attractive, it has to be less than that.
Yeah.
So let's say it's £12. So then the question is, okay, well, who's taking the hit on that? And is it that you're taking £1.50 off the video subscription and £1.50 off the music subscription? And obviously, on the music side, subscription streaming is a revenue share business. The way everyone in the music industry gets paid is they share in the total amount of revenue that comes in based on a consumption share metric. So the more revenue comes in per user, the more money there is in the pot for everybody in the music industry to share. And it happens that in the last couple of years, some people at some record companies, and on the publishing side too, have become slightly obsessed by this thing that is sometimes referred to as the ARPU.
Yeah, okay.
Average revenue per user.
Yeah.
Because although the classic price point for subscription streaming was set at $9.99 by Daniel Ek in the early days of Spotify, and Deezer was also the same, so by the time Apple came along, that price point had already been set. Actually, a lot of people are not paying $9.99 a month, because we've already alluded here in the UK, you have the Vodafone bundle. Vodafone aren't paying the full price. You've got the student discount, the family plan, etc. And as you go around the world, clearly, you're not going to charge the equivalent of £10 in markets like India, because if you did, you would make it a luxury product and a really small number of people would buy it. So you're making it basically the economic equivalent of £10 in that market, which ends up being something like £3. And so as a result, if you take Spotify or Apple and you take their entire user base across the world, ignore the free users on the Spotify side, but if you take all the paying users across the world, and then you average it out, then actually the average revenue per user is coming down. It's not £10, it's £8, it's £7, it's £6, it's £4. I know one person I spoke to from one of the streaming services was expressing some frustration at labels becoming obsessed, as some people have, by the ARPU in the last couple of years. And they were basically saying, you go to record industry events and they spend the first 5 minutes getting really excited about all the growth in Latin America and how that's really exciting. And then the next 5 minutes slagging off the fact that the average subscriber revenue on Spotify is going down. It's like, well, those two things are linked.
Yeah.
The fact we have more subscribers in Latin America, which are not paying £10 a month, is one of the reasons it's coming down. But this whole thing about average revenue per user has been a talking point. And obviously, bundling is another contributing factor that brings it down. So I think that's why we're seeing some pushback, which is, well, hang on a second, are you suggesting we'll get $10, $8, $7? You know, what is the deal here? Great that you're signing up more users, but not if it's further bringing down the average revenue per user.
Yes, and I suppose the difference between Amazon and Apple is Amazon selling its music streaming services, although it's built up different tiers over time, was that it was signing up people who would not usually have gone for a streaming service, more mainstream subscribers, people who don't want to spend £10 a month on music.
And who may not even yet be really aware it's an option.
Yes.
Whereas Amazon have the email addresses and they can flog it to those people.
But they're signing up for the next day delivery on Amazon Prime. They're getting a video service in there. That's nice. And then they get their smart speaker and they realise that they can ask it to play music and they can just get the free service, or they can pay a little bit of money to get slightly more on-demand functionality on their smart speaker. And that sort of draws people in who aren't your Spotify-type subscriber. And Apple has really been going for the Spotify-type of subscriber rather than the Amazon mainstream person who only wants to spend a couple of quid at most on music.
Yeah, so that, I suppose that is the difference, isn't it, between why were they fine with the Amazon bundles? I mean, actually, behind the scenes, they weren't always fine with the Amazon bundles, but they accepted it. Whereas, yeah, I suspect the fear on the Apple side is that rather than this bundle resulting in lots of new TV people adding music on, what will happen is that lots of Apple Music subscribers will use it to add TV on, and in doing so, what is currently a $10 a month or £10 a month subscriber will become an £8 or $8 a month subscriber, and that subscriber will get some TV on the side. So it could have a tangible hit on the existing Apple Music subscriber base, will be the fear.
So the Financial Times says that talks between Apple and the labels over this music and TV bundle are at an early stage and actual pricing formulas are still to be discussed. It might be that Apple ultimately decides to take the full hit on the TV service, allow basically the music service still to be $9.99 a month, and then add a couple of quid for TV, and then everyone's happy because Apple gets to grow its TV service and the music industry gets to keep all its money from those subscribers. I mean, that's not sustainable long term.
No, it is true, because the video on demand services are licensed slightly differently, there is more flexibility on Apple's side in order to do that, to take like a $2, $3 hit on the video subscription. But yeah, I mean, I would agree with you. You have to think, even if that's how they manage to get this through, because I assume they want to start selling this bundle quite soon. I mean, the video service is going live next month.
Yes.
So it might be to get it to market quickly that's what they agree. But yeah, I would agree with you that I can't see them wanting to do that forever. And if it turns out this is a really popular bundle, I think ultimately it will be, you've got to take a bit of a hit on that. But Apple's argument would be, look at all the other people that we've signed up. And I guess that will be the test. Is it actually you've signed up 20 million people who are already Apple Music subscribers, so actually we're losing money? Or have you got 30 million people doing music who hadn't previously done music, so we are £7 to £8 per subscriber a month better off?
Yes, although obviously the TV service is the cheaper of the two subscriptions, so adding an extra £7, £8 to your £4.99 subscription is much different to adding £2 to your £9.99 subscription. So it would seem like it would probably be more attractive to existing Apple Music subscribers than people who are going for the TV service and want a bit of music.
But it now sounds like, despite you being a bit snarky at the start of this section about the labels pushing back again, that you're saying they're right to push back.
Yeah, but given all of the music streaming services are still very much in growth and not making any profit, and basically all offering roughly the same product, there's very little to distinguish between each one in reality, then actually adding TV onto Apple Music does possibly make it a more attractive proposition if someone's trying to choose between that and Spotify or Deezer or whatever. So maybe, I mean, Spotify's obviously tried to do this in the US, bundling with Hulu. I don't know how successful that's been, but you need to distinguish yourself somehow, and having a music and TV bundle might attract more new people to Apple, or even away from Spotify. It might get people off Spotify and onto Apple.
But that's good for Apple, but not for the labels.
Well, okay, if they're poaching Spotify customers, maybe not. But if it's getting more new people in, if it increases the rate of growth, then maybe that's a positive. But we'll see. I mean, they're going to do it anyway, so why are we even talking about it?
Of course, the outcome of all of this could be that all of these various attempts by Apple and the big movie studios and Disney and people like that to take on Netflix and Amazon could all die a death quite quickly. And we'll go back. I mean, someone was saying, because obviously, not so much of Apple, but because the old school studios in America are all trying to launch their own streaming services, they're all slowly pulling content off Netflix and Amazon, yeah, aren't they? But it will sort of be, yeah, we've got to wait 2 years for those to fail. And then they'll all start putting their content back onto Netflix and Amazon. So we will see. We, you know, okay, yes, there have been some Apple products, iPad comes to mind, where you thought, yeah, that's not going to work, and we were wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But then there have been some Apple things, their smart speaker, for example, where they are quite late to the party, and it hasn't really taken off. So we will see, I guess.
That's all we've got time for this week. If you've got any questions or comments about this week's episode, let us know. setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty, edited by Jason Wolfe. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.